Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, we'd like to welcome you to another special edition of Africa on the Moon. That's right, Africa is on the Moon. We are continuing a series of African Liberation Day 2014, Africans Must Unite. This is a continuation of the various series that have taken place for the past week or so. This is a critical issue, the issue of this unification of Africa and African people. And when we talk about this institution, this great institution that we call African Liberation Day, it's an institution that has been in existence ever since 1958, came out of African Freedom Day on April 15 and on May 25th at the 1963, at the convening of the Organization of African Unity. They changed it from African Freedom Day to African Liberation Day. And since that time, it has been an institution that marked the ongoing progress of the liberation of our people as an institution that only can grow and grow and grow until our people are totally free, until Africa is totally free, until Africa is totally liberated, unified, and socialist. So with us tonight, we have, again, organizers, special people of conscience. We have dedicated our lives to play a role and make a contribution in this area of trying to free Africa, African people, and all of humanity. So right now, we can go to our panelists for the night. I will ask them briefly, just give a brief introduction in terms of who they are and the nature of their work for those who have not heard that program, and they are coming in for the first time. So we start out with Brother Haki Kamafi Muchoki. He's an organizer for the African Awareness Association. Welcome, Brother Haki. Can you give our people just a brief perspective of who you are, the nature of the work that you do under the African Awareness Association?
Sure. I've been doing this for close to 30 years, and my primary focus is building institutions specifically to combat the economic and social ills impacting our people. I feel that if we are to overcome these serious opposition in society, I think it's very, very relevant, quite important that we institutions to concretely, you know, get people to understand the necessity of struggle. So that's what I'm dedicated to.
Okay, next we have with us Brother Nefa Freeman, who is with the International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five. Brother Nefa, welcome to Africa on the Move. And can you just tell the people a little something about who you are and the nature of the work that you're doing under this particular committee to free the five?
I'm just one of a core group of organizers of the committee. The International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five is a network of concerned people from different countries on all the major continents working to raise awareness about the case of the Cuban Five in order to build a broad-based mass movement that will win their freedom back to their home in Cuba. And also to looking at the other areas of U.S. policy toward Cuba that are very pervasive and hindering other people's struggle.
Okay. Excellent. Next we have with our Sister Izeli Danto. She's working with the Haitian movement. She's part of the Haiti Lawyer Network, and she has other organizations that is working around Haiti. We'll bring our sister in, and we'll ask our sisters just to share a little bit about who she is and the nature of the work that she does. Welcome, Sister Izeli.
Brotherly honor and respect to everyone. My name is Izeli Dantal. I have been an attorney for many decades. I do human rights work, and I run the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network and the Free Haiti Movement. I was born in Haiti, raised in the United States, and I went back to Haiti as a lawyer representing the first democratically elected government of Haiti after the Haitian people got rid of Duvalier. And I have been since then working to change the colonial narrative on Haiti, which allows for the second occupation of Haiti that started in 2004, has been going on for over 10 years now, by the colonial army that the U.S. has down in Haiti. So we work on various issues. We provide the non-colonial narrative on Haiti. We run the Free Haiti movement. We run a very large network that reaches about 4 million people. We have we've been at this for decades, and that's what I do.
Excellent, excellent. Well, as you know, coming up in a few days, we're going to be celebrating 56 years of African Liberation Day, which will take place on May the 17th in Washington, D.C. at the Festival Center located at 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest. This African Liberation Day is being organized and coordinated by the All African People's Revolutionary Party, G.C. And this year's focus for African Liberation Day is on Smash Neo-Colonialist Intelligentsia, the True Face of the Counter Revolution. That's the spirit, that's the direction that this particular ARD will be taking place. And we would like to invite our listening audience to come on out. Many of the participants that you have heard on the series, they have been invited, and they will be at African Liberation Day. So not only will you have a chance to talk to them by phone, but you can talk to them live. This is one of the things what African Liberation Day does. It allows you to connect on the ground with people who are doing the work, and it also will give you a better perspective and understanding the international aspects of how these movements and struggles work together. Given the fact I have stated that, let's go straight to the source. We're going to talk about Africa. I know, Brother Medford, you also have had a chance to spend some time and do some work in Africa. More particularly, you have done some work around Zimbabwe. I basically would just like to ask you, in terms of Medford, can you just explain to your audience why is it important that we connect with Africa, with those Africans in the diaspora?
Well, I think it's important because as people of African descent, we have not just a common circumstance or a common situation that befalls us no matter where we are in the world, but also the solution to that problem. And, you know, it just requires us to be able to come together, make connections. We have to, in this day and age, it's important for the institutions that we build and the movements that we create to be transnational. And so that means the institutions and things that we do have to affect our people across continents. And so no longer can we thwart off the encroachment of imperialism in the various places that we are if we're not organized in a global scale. And this is not, you know, this is not new actually for us. It's in terms of, I mean, this was the situation during the time of Nkrumah. This is what Nkrumah was helping us understand, that we have to do this. And so now we look at a world that proves the foresight and the envision of people like Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré, and that we have, that's why. And so we have to make those connections. We can't, and then often in this the situation that we're in now, we're bombarded with media and those things that will give us different allegiances or make us think we have different interests that we actually have. So very interesting, the topic that you said, smashing neo-colonialist intelligentsia, because right now we see this intelligentsia playing very sophisticated roles within the ranks of our movement. And they're posing as the most progressive and sometimes we'll even say revolutionary things, ways, but they're not that. They're actually agents, either unwittingly or wittingly, of imperialism and the imperialist governments. And I'll give you an example really quickly. The agents that, for instance, the social justice, now there's a term that's often used called civil society. And we kind of know what civil society means. I guess those who are just who are not part of the government, the official government, but they're the organized masses. They're organized. They're doing things. They're not even necessarily the masses. Well, but they're organized groups. So this sector or effort among the people has been co-opted by imperialism. And so you'll see these organizations and groups of people organizing to what seems progressive, the rights of women, the rights of workers, and the rights of youth, and they're championing, you know, the cause to not have corporations, supposedly not have corporations dominating, you know, our lives. But at the same time, they don't. But at the same time, because their sustenance, their money and everything, and even their ideological orientation comes from the West. It comes from imperialism. For example, all the workers' unions and youth groups, a lot of them are funded by the United States Agency for International Development. They're funded by trade unions that are European in nature. And then I'm just talking about the United States U.S. Agency for International Development, but Britain has a counterpart, the U.K. has a counterpart, all of them have these same type of institutions, and they fund our movements, and they make our movements indebted to them, and they also give them short-sightedness when it comes to the overarching problems that affect our people. And so in this sense, they become an intelligentsia. A lot of them, they're scraping the people right out. When I say scraping, they're taking our youth and our people who are coming right out of college, and they're corralling them, kind of guiding them into these jobs that are actually jobs that really are supporting the system and giving a guide to the system. So they're never actually challenging the status quo. They'll never bring up the contradictions, the theoretical and philosophical and even practical contradictions that deal with us. They only do a surface thing, enough that it makes it look good and gives our people and makes our people support them and what their activities, but at the same time, when it comes to more revolutionary, transformative things, then our people are dissuaded from them. And so it's important to get back to, and I'll end here, the importance of your question is that these organizations are working on a global level. They're working across continents, and that we have to be able to work as revolutionary Pan-Africanist forces work in the same way across continents and make those connections so that our movement is more sophisticated and deals with the exigencies of our time.
You know, Nefer, that's interesting to the last point you raised about the connectedness, why we must work together based upon what the enemy is doing. I was reading a book a while back, and one of the things the author mentioned was, he said ever since World War II, I believe, that no European country never went into battle with another country where they fought them by themselves. They always had collaboration support by other European countries. So it becomes very difficult for any other countries to take on Western nations, because not only are they taking on that particular nation, they're trying to dominate them, but they're taking on other nations that are is part of the Western alliance. And for our people, I think that is real critical, because even though we are affected all around the world where we live at, we tend to be in these isolation ways of thinking that we only can fight just when the conflicts are battle here, and understand how difficult the task that we are against if we only can eliminate ourselves as one entity fighting this bigger picture of global capitalism and imperialism. So it makes sense, as Malcolm said, to reach out and work with those that you have in common. But it makes more sense to understand, historically speaking, this is why the existence of Pan-Africanism came into existence, because it says and tells you it becomes very difficult for African people, no matter where we are, to be able to solve their problems if they're not connected and doesn't have a serious sound base in which it can raise its struggle from. And we know that those as Pan-Africanists understand Africa must be that base, because it's only because they are controlling Africa. This is why we have the suffering, whether we're in the United States, whether we're in Brazil, whether we're in the Far East, or whether or not we're in the Caribbean Islands. And given the fact that I made that transition to speak on that, I would like to address this question to Brother Haki from the African Wellness Association. Brother Haki, in terms of looking at our problems, and based on what Brother Nefer just said, there are all kinds of tools of oppression that the West have used and are using. Can you talk to our people and give us maybe some concrete examples? What type of tools and examples that they are using against our people that allow them to control us and oppress us? Was it psychologically? Was it economically? Was it culturally? It's all kinds of games going on, and our people are not aware of the games, and so they become so unconscious. This is one reason to allow the enemy to continue to dominate our people. What are some of the tools that they use from your perspective, Haki, in terms of this question of oppression?
Yeah, well, probably the best tool to use is no question is economics. There's a reason they call it the dismal science. That's the reason why. In fact, you know, what economics profess to be and what it really is theoretically is two different ball games. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what capitalism professes to be theoretically and what it is concretely are two different ball games. So often we are under the illusion that capitalism can serve the greatest good, that if in fact that you empower some, then in fact it's going to benefit the rest of society. Of course, we know that's not real. And what happens is that in the context of capitalist society, when you have a system that's essentially top-heavy, inevitably what it means is that the money's at the top doesn't filter down to the money at the bottom. And as a consequence, those people at the bottom don't benefit in terms of economic activity that takes place. Now, to give you an example, in America, we talk about the 1% of the population controlling 90% of the wealth. And we talk the other percentage, 99%, basically competing over very small amounts of overall wealth. So in that context of that 1% controlling so much, it does a disservice in terms of the overall function of the economy, which means that there's not money going through the system in terms of, you know, circulating through that system in terms of expanding that economy. And if it doesn't expand that economy, it can't do the kind of things it needs to do in terms of addressing the needs and aspirations of its people. And that's and more problematic is that not only does it not benefit the system in terms of its operations, but also it means it undermines the very system itself, which is capitalism. Can you hear me?
Just continue to talk. We can hear you. We're going to make adjustments. We're making an adjustment. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I'm just hearing myself twice, and so, all right. Anyway, all right. So when the system undermines itself, means that the capitalism system itself is in disarray, which means that it doesn't generate the necessary money. Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Continue.
Elie, let me call you back.
Okay, we have no problems. We're gonna delay Brother Hackey and we're going to our next caller. Sister Izeli, when we talk about African Liberation Day, we talk about the need to unite and look at our problem from a global perspective in Africa and the African diaspora. We know African people are strugglers. They are people who resist at all times, under all conditions, when it comes to our oppression. Many people will believe that our people are not fighters, are not resistors. And we believe that looking at the history of the Africans in the Western Hemisphere, Haiti is a good example of the real history of the continual resistance against Western domination and the imperialist system. For our audience who may have never heard you before, for our audience who don't know nothing about the history of Haiti and the struggle of the Haitian people, can you give our people a historical backdrop of the history of Haiti and what are some of the things that we can learn from them?
Yes, certainly. Today Haiti is under occupation, but we have been, the masses in Haiti have been fighting the imperialists since 1503 when the first boatload of Africans were brought in chains by the Spanish to the island called, that they ended up calling Hispaniola, but which my ancestors regained and renamed as Haiti, which is the name that the Taínos who were living on the island that the Spanish and the French killed had named that island. And so we had a revolution. Haiti is the first country in the world that was created out of people who were formerly enslaved. And the first group of people who did not take the culture, the name, or the religion of their former masters or any of the Europeans or even the Arabs with regards to who and what they are. On August 14, 1791, when the Haitian Revolution started, the Africans who became Haitians in the land of the Taínos went back to Africa. They went back to the traditional religion of Africa. And we're talking about, there were about over 200,000 Haitians died in that 13-year war from 1791 to 1804 when we declared independence and have been independent since then. But on that island, that island that I think and most Haitians think is sort of the sacred trust of Africa, the place where we are the experiment of being independent outside of these new crusades of the Europeans, the place where Africa not only didn't take on, and the Africans who fought were people who were also forcibly converted as Muslims, people from the north, people who were sold by what we're called, what we see now, you know, the people in northern Africa who had suffered this discontinuity of Africa development with regards to the invasions of the Arabs in those Maghreb and other northwest nations. So we are the Africans, actually, that have dealt with those issues, the issues of the Bafiotes. And I've talked about what Bafiotes are. They're literally the black collaborators with empire. So Haitian Revolution had a simple pattern, and this is how we were able to win. In that pattern, that call at Bois Caïma was for, and I'm going, it was set in the Kikongo language because the amalgamated tribes who became Haitian were from, you know, various places in West Africa going all the way down from Angola to the Congo. And so we had black folks who had different ethnic and cultural values, but they came together as one. So if we're talking about Pan-Africanism, in my blood that runs. That's what IET is. They came together as one. And it is as one that they fought the European tribes who came together as one, calling themselves white, even though they had spent thousands and thousands of years killing each other. And, you know, Ukraine, for instance, right now, when the Mongols invaded the Ukraine in the 1200s or whatever, that's where the name slave comes from, because they used to march them by the village down to the Black Sea and enslave them. So there is a whole world out there of information, I think, that our people are certainly not aware of, you know, whether it was the jihad and the Holocaust of black people going to the east, or the Crusades and the Holocaust of black people going to the west, which is what we are, the descendants of the what I call the Crusades of 1492 that has not yet ended, and that is now intensifying with the what we see as Boko Haram and Nigeria and the U.S. invasion of these places in AFRICOM. So we're going to see some of the same issues that Haiti had to deal with and the Africans in West Africa had to deal with when they stopped the jihad up at the Sahara. So I come from a lineage of warriors, warriors who did not lose their history and warriors whose history is told orally. And so in 1791, after 300 years of enslavement and terrible, terrible brutality, the Africans in Haiti, and we're talking about just not males, and I know that's only males that are upheld in history, but the gathering that began the Haitian Revolution and the reason I was given the name Ezélie Danton is the gathering of, there's a historical Ezélie Danton. Ezélie Danton is Africans actually understand, at least Haitians, what mythology is about and how important it is, where metaphors work and parables work to tell more than the details will tell. And so the irreducible essence of the mother energy, of the love principle, of peace, of justice, that's what Ezélie Danton is. And it is that energy that was universal within all of the various tribes who came together at that gathering that started the Haitian Revolution. And it's important for me to just concentrate on that just for a second so I can bring you to 2014. In that arena, you have a woman by the name of Cécile Fatima. Now, everyone sort of knows that Fatima is an Arabic name, you have a man by the name of Bookman, which is Book of Man of the Book, who came out of Jamaica, Duty Bookman. Duty Bookman was the first leader of the Haitian Revolution in 1791. Esli Fatima was the mambo, the priestess, who chose who would lead the revolution. And it's a replication of things that go way beyond what we know in terms of how history is told. It goes to the fact of where women were before patriarchy came along, you know, 6,000 years ago, before the conquest of Africa by the Arabs and then by the European tribes. So what Haiti stands for is this new, shining, different world where women can be priests and priestesses and can lead and can be warriors, because the warrior that led the Haitian Revolution, that started the Haitian Revolution, as I said, you know, people who were forcefully converted by but when they were enslaved in Haiti, they all went back to Vodun. They went back to the traditional practices and the gods that danced in their heads, that provided them with the strength and self-knowledge, and that's how Haiti began. And that's what makes Haiti so different from every other nation state that has been founded since 1492 in the Western Hemisphere. Now, remember that blacks are aboriginal to the world, so it is not to say this is the first African or black republic, because we are aboriginal to the world and have had a history that goes beyond the 6,000 years of the European history of Genesis. So the concept of a woman and of a mother and of an irreducible essence coming and being lionized by veteran soldiers. These were soldiers. These were people who fought. They were the Maroons. And so they got together, and the call, as I always say, was we have to stop the white imperialist, Blanc Colomb. We have to stop the black collaborator, and we have to stop all the evil forces. And the evil forces are the same thing that they are in 1804 that they are in 2014. The evil forces of the white imperialist, biological fatalist, is their religion, their media, their schooling, their banking system, which is just from feudalism to capitalism, same sort of concept of having taking money from the poor to support the bankers and the corporatocracy and so forth. So I think there are lessons to be learned from Haiti. I think it's very disappointing to Haitians who fight and who try to keep that island, that right now all the nations, including those who say they are anti-imperialist, but all the nations in the Western Hemisphere have turned a blind eye to the fact that the United States has, you know, the gentleman was talking about civil society and how it is a tool of empire. Well, that's how the new post-Cold War colonialism works. They learn through the gains that were made by civil society during the 60s and during the independence movements of Africa. And now they own the media, and so the media will not ever talk about Esli Danton. They will not ever talk about really any blacks who stand for self-love and independence and a traditional way of value, a value where you do not put profit over people, a value where you actually feel responsible for taking care of those that are weaker, and specifically taking care of children and protecting them. I mean, those are the things that Haiti stands for, but you will not see it in the mass media, which is why for the last 20 years since I got to Haiti and I was pretty much kicked out by Larry Swing and the U.S. ambassador in Haiti, who specifically told me anyways, because I went in with the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network in 1994. that they were not expecting Haitians of my caliber with the idea of until 50 years from now. So the white supremacist has a program that that is way ahead of wherever we are. They know why they are doing what they're doing. You know, geographically, Haiti is between Cuba and Venezuela. Those are the two places that the United States want to become client states. So if they can take the resources and the property and stop Haiti from any sort of nationalization of it, then it's a base for them with regards to Cuba. It's a base for them with regards to Venezuela.
Interesting. I know earlier you mentioned the issue of the resources of Haiti that a lot of people may not be aware of, and that may be one of the motivations why they're there. Can you just talk a little bit about that for our audience?
Yeah. I think the audience, probably most people who do not read Edley Dantal, do not know that the U.S. government built the fourth largest U.S. embassy in the world in Haiti after they got rid of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And I'm talking about when we say it's the fourth largest embassy, it's after places that, you know, they have large U.S. presence that we know that always in the news with regards to U.S. interests. It's after, you know, Afghanistan. They have big base since in Germany since World War II, in China. So you have Afghanistan. We used to be the fifth, but now that they've brought down their presence in Iraq, we are now the fourth largest. So you're talking about people know about U.S. interests in Iraq. People know about U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and in China and in Germany, but they do not know, that Haiti, tiny Haiti, houses all of these thousands and thousands of U.S. People and the compound that they built. And it's because of our mining resources. Haiti, other than Cuba, Haiti and Cuba are the oldest land masses in the Americas, going back a billion years. We have assets. I have a piece out. If you go to YouTube and you put Edley Dantal, it talks about Haiti's riches. It talks about my work. It's about a 20-minute piece, and if you you will get to know what our resources is. But I'm just going to just highlight the few. Cuba has oil. We have Venezuela has oil. Haiti lies in the same waters. The United States, in addition to not just the United States, the U.S. Euro white settlers and tribes, in addition to capitalism, is about making acceptable profit for the few. And to do that, a lot of times, the world is abundant, and they have to suppress resources. So they keep chaos, for instance, going on in Africa in order so that the Middle East prices of gas and oil and so forth with Saudi Arabia and the others collaborators will stay high. So Haiti has a lot of oil. The United States found it back in the 1950s. Some go back to 1920. I have a piece on it called The U.S. Occupation of Haiti, The Economic Reasons for It. Haitian geologists say that our oil is there's more oil in Haiti lands and waters than there is in Venezuela, that the head of Venezuelan oil is found in Haitian on the Haitian Gulf up there in Port-au-Prince, the Gulf of Port-au-Prince. And so the United States know all of that. You could read the reports. So part of what you do is there's a new tool of imperialism besides civil society. The United States hires all of these Haitians to work in these non-for-profits or NGOs. So to be the face of this civil society, and so to sort of dilute the idea that there's racism and there's a occupation going on. But in addition to those, the UN is a tool, the OAS, even CARICOM discriminates against Haiti. We are the only country that requires to have a visa, where CARICOM, which is that represents the 15 islands in the Caribbean, they all have a motherland. Jamaica has England, Martinique has France. Haiti has no motherland. We are by ourselves. So the resources are, they have admitted that Haiti has $20 billion in gold, and if that but Haitians are saying $200 billion. They have admitted that Haiti has, I think they said that Haiti has, the United States has something like $8 billion in copper. We have iridium. We have some of the important strategic materials, cobalt, iridium, uranium. We have those. But most importantly, it's the gas and oil. And because Haiti has this old landmass and the mountains are so old, pharmaceutical companies go in there and they are using a lot of the Haitian sediment and the rocks. There's a super antibiotic that they get out of the land that they use for pharmaceuticals. All that's being done behind this UN occupation and this idea that Haiti needs charity. But those who want to understand is that Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton at the State Department, Bill Clinton at the UN, collected over $9 billion with regards to earthquake aid. So there is a sense that, first of all, they're suppressing Haiti resources in order to maintain the high rate of their gasoline resources, and they want to make Haiti a transshipment port just like Djibouti. Over there where AFRICOM is, you know, just look at Djibouti, and this is what they want to do with Haiti. And then when they're ready, strategically ready, then they will admit. At times, the United States have, some geologists have admitted to Haiti's oil, but like right after the earthquake, some guy came out, some geologist said he'd been working in Haiti for over 30 years, and that the earthquake itself, because we are on a fault line, and because there is, just like in the Middle East, Haiti is under like three different tectonic plates, like different continents that are just grinding away at the bottom of Haiti. So it's like the Middle East, and that grind is what like brings up the fossil fuel. So part of what they're doing with their compound in Haiti is underground, part of it, and that's why you have a lot of earthquake tremors in Haiti, is that fracking, so those are the, but the mainstream media, which is totally co-opted, which is in no way the same media, for instance, as Brother Haki was saying yesterday, that inadvertently, gave room to and voice to, let's say, Malcolm X back in the day, or who showed the hoses that were that were dispersing the demonstrators and children and so forth, because that helped bring down, part of apartheid in America. Well, today we're in a whole different new world where mass incarceration has replaced outright slavery and all of that stuff. And the media works for the corporatocracy. And in that space, the Haitian Lawyers Leadership stands. And I write with regards to what's really happening in Haiti. But we are fighting. And as one of the brothers said, we are fighting alone because what they say is democratic as opposed to Republican, liberal as opposed to neocon, bullshit. It's all exactly the same. They all work for the same master, Wall Street. So in Haiti, for instance, we named Dr. Paul Farmer in the Harvard crew. Harvard is like the replacement for the Chicago Boys, who basically created neoliberalism, and now it's Harvard. And you can tell we have everything is right wing in America, and in that right wing, they're getting ready to try to take over all of Africa with AFRICOM. Including trying to go up to North Africa, where they were stopped, of course, by the Crusades back in whatever the 1300s.
Excellent, excellent presentation of the history of the struggle of the Haitian people. It's a history that we very rarely hear, and I think it's always important that when we get a chance to find out the true history from a people movement, we should always go to the people who are fighting to have created a movement, and we'd like to commend you, sister, for the excellent information. And let's continue to move forward. I believe we have Haki back on the line, and Brother Haki, we're trying to get you to articulate some of the forms and tools of oppression they use against our people so we can begin to make a better assessment of how to wage our struggle. and ways to fight. But before we do this, before we let Brother Haki comes on, we can ask everybody to be mindful that this is a special edition in the series of African Liberation Day 2014. Africans must unite. We are celebrating 56 years of history of African Liberation Day, and this Saturday we'd like to encourage all Africans and people of goodwill to come on up to Washington, D.C. on May 17 to the Festival Center located at 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest, Washington, D.C. from 2 to 5 p.m. and help celebrate African Liberation Day. Come and meet and learn the history of our people, the struggle of our people. Meet the people who are in the process of trying to make their contribution, and we hope we can inspire you to come in and help join with them, because we only can do this collectively together. And many individuals that you have heard on this program and others, you also may get a chance to see them and meet them personally. African Liberation Day is your weekend. It's your day. It's your institution. Your mother's calling you. So please, to find out more information, we encourage you to go to the AAPRPTC website. Go to www.aaprp-gc.org to have more information on that particular event. Plus, we encourage you to help not only participate, but also help make a proper contribution in terms of financially speaking. We know when we talk about freedom, freedom is not free. Anytime when there are economic dependency, there can be no freedom. So we also must learn to support our movement. So we want to encourage everybody to go out. And to our callers who've been on the line for a while, we'll be coming to you in 10 minutes. We'd like to encourage people to call in at 323-679-0841. If you want to speak or have a comment, make sure you punch 1 once you call in the number. Call in 323-679-0841. Punch 1, and we'll acknowledge you by your last 4 number. In 10 minutes, caller, stay on, and we are coming to you. Brother Haki, can you just give us some examples of the various forms of tools that they use to oppress our people?
Yeah, I think, thanks for your patience. I apologize. Apparently, some people want to play on the phone. But in any event, the biggest problem is that it's one of declining capitalism. See, we often the media doesn't report, in fact, that the system is in crisis, that capitalism is in fact in crisis, and they don't report that. So when you look at things like falling wages, and you look at unemployment, and you look at the city's inability, you know, to provide for its people, they're all symptomatic of the fact that the system is, in fact, in crisis. And so when we talk about this top-head reality in terms of capitalism, where a few people control everything, it does a real disservice in terms of the overall function of capitalism. So in other words, what it means is that the people who run the system the people who run the system are experiencing real problems in terms of their ability to meet cash flows on a global scale, to meet their ability, you know, to pay for those services in which they've got on credit. So it creates a real instability in terms of the overall function of the system. Now, one of the things you would think, that given the reality in terms of the dysfunction of capitalism, that the obvious solution would be socialism. But socialism is not an option in a capitalist society, because those at the top are committed to a system in which they benefit. And so, therefore, all of those things like unemployment, lack of education, lack of food and shelter for the people will go on unabated. So this is the thing we have to understand in terms of capitalism. Now, that crisis, and just in terms of fulfilling that deficit, is very important in terms of, you know, trying to get money into the system in terms of being able to actually survive. Now, even though the system, even though the Federal Reserve prints up $85 billion a month, in terms of being able to pay its bills, it's not enough in terms of the overall deficit, in terms of, we're talking about national debt in excess of, you know, $22 trillion, even though the media would tell you that the federal deficit, national deficit is only $17 trillion, when in fact it's closer to $22 trillion. And so it means that in terms of just of being able to exist is problematic. So it's not a position to actually bother in terms of actually, you know, talking to people about, you know, their resources and actually being able to purchase those resources. For the capitalists, it's simply a question of taking what you want. So in that context, the question in terms of Africa becomes very palatable in terms of why they're doing the kind of things they do in Africa. So, for instance, when you look at the evolution of AFRICOM in Africa, and you ask why the hell are these people in Africa all over the place, out of 54 states, 52 actually have AFRICOM members, U.S. soldiers, you know, who are stationed there. The question is, what are their role there? They're clearly not there to help Africa. They're not there to stimulate the economy. They're not there to create institutions that are going to empower the people. So why are they there? Clearly, their focus there is because of U.S., so-called U.S. interests. And these interests does include helping Africa. And so, therefore, by having these people stationed in Africa, you have a situation where conveniently, not only can they use the technology in terms of destabilizing Africa, but in a perfect position to actually determine who in Africa should be eliminated, who in Africa stands up against U.S. foreign policy, who in Africa is in a position to challenge, you know, U.S. hegemony, you know, as pertains to global capitalism. So they're in a position to do all that. And not only in a position to do all that, but in a perfect position to actually liquidate those individuals who, quote-unquote, pose a threat to global capitalism. And so this is the problem in terms of the decline of the capitalist system. And so we understand that all these things that are going to Africa is a direct result of the currentness that exists in this so-called global capitalist system. You have to understand that. Now, capitalism plays a different role in terms of when you talk about America. Now, in Africa, you want to take the resources, but in America, it's a different paradox. In America, what happens is inevitably you create a situation where you have a large number of people which serve no constructive need in terms of the imperatives of the capitalist system. And so, therefore, the question is, for all these people you don't need, what do you do with all of these people you don't need? Now, we often talk about this whole Malthusian principle in terms of this notion that, you know, when you got too many people in existence, when they threaten the powerful, when they threaten the interests of the powerful, that when it comes to cause it to feed, clothe, and shelter people, then you got to find some way to eradicate a large number of people. Now, we're not at that point in history yet where they're actually willing to actually do that, but clearly they're grooming the right wing for that purpose. But certainly, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that there is a war of attrition going on in the context of, you know, in America, particularly directed toward the African community. when we look at the problem in terms of poor health of African people, we look at diabetes, we look at heart problems, we look at hypertension, high blood pressure. When we look at all these things, they disproportionately affect African people. And the question becomes, why does it disproportionately affect African people? Now, clearly, you know, when you talk about those kind of melodies that impact on African lives, and clearly, two things come to mind. Food and stress contribute greatly to the ills that a lot of our people suffer. And the question is, why do our people disproportionately are affected by lack of good food and stress? Well, could it be that maybe this is a genius way in terms of actually eliminate the numbers of people, you know, African people in society? That is something to pose. I mean, that's something to think about. But it's clearly there's this war of attrition that's going on. When you look at the incarceration rate of African males, I mean, which is unbelievable. In fact, I read a couple months ago where members of the UN actually stated that given what's happening to African people, and particularly African young males, given the fact what's happening to them to this high incarceration rate, the African people in America will be within their right to take up arms because it's simply unacceptable. And I concur. Now, if in fact this would happen to any other, to white youth, I can guarantee you there will be all kind of movements to address this problem. So clearly, the needs of the capitalist class in terms of limiting the numbers of African people in America is probably a real prerequisite in terms of, as they see it, in terms of maintaining control. So I think this is the way it plays itself out in America.
Excellent. Okay, what we're going to do right now, we're going to open up our phone lines to our listening audience. Feel free to call in 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. And when you call in, make sure you hit 1 so we can recognize your call. Right now we have a call on line 3330, call 3330. Can you hear us, caller? 3330. Welcome to Africa on the Move, caller 3330. Your question or comment, please.
I'd like to make a comment.
Okay, go right ahead.
Comment in regards to this discussion on neocolonialism. It's amazing when you talk about those people that seek to maintain a colonial presence, there's always this concept of divide and conquer. Because, unfortunately, one of the issues that plagues Africa is there's an identity crisis, and rather than allow the African people to see themselves as being part of one big family, they're at odds with each other. So they enable it to be easier for organizations like AFRICOM to come in and side with one group versus the other. And then you get this situation where there are many conflicts within the one big conflict that globalism creates.
Okay, Carlo, we thank you for your response. Do anybody want to just add to something that the young brother just stated? Okay.
I think he was right on point.
Okay, good, right on point. This is one of the youth that have decided to make a conscious effort to join in the people's struggle. This is Brother Zabari, for the audience who may not know him. And, you know, we must commend him because when we look at our youth today, we can see how they have intentionally confused our youth. And I'd like to raise this question with you, Brother Napa. In terms of this question of looking at our youth, how do we get back in control of our youth, given all of this confusion that's coming after them? How do you address the youth question, particularly in terms of when you try to get them to understand the connection to Africa and to be African? We still now see...
Brother Lee, are you dating us?
No, we're not. So it is an excellent question that we also have to deal with. And I know you have had many experiences of working with the youth, so that's why I'm directing this question at you. And as well as others on the panel,
but
I'd like to get your response to the people. How do you deal with the youth issue today and make them become more responsible, more conscious? That's the question.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind for me, and the way you said, I feel that I should probably say I'm 50 years old. But I think it's a mistake to think that it's only about the youth that need to be brought into line. You know, just like if the young brother who just came on, and he's reflecting the fact that our youth are great. And so in that sense, there's a connection. I agree with you on that we do need to make that connection. But it'll be difficult to make it if we don't acknowledge or recognize the greatness of our youth, and you know, because they're going to know if we don't recognize. You know, everybody knows when they're not being respected. And so we have to do that. We have to be able to look at the genius that's coming out, that's out here today, which means we have to keep up with certain things that might be a little bit more difficult to keep up with in our own, right, you know, the culture and everything. You know, even for us, it was the same thing. But I think we have to look at, like we did with our own, is in our own generation, is who are the like-minded people among our youth, like the one who just spoke or whoever else we all work with, some people that are youth. And we have to, you know, they just have confidence in them and rest assured that, you know, they will ask us what they need from us. And we just have to be willing to give it.
You know, in terms of looking at Africa and its alliances in terms of various organization movements who have made a conscious decision to align itself up with Africa, African people. When we look at these alliances and these movements, one of the movements that comes to play is around the issue of Cuba, Cuba role as it relates to Africa development. What has been the historical relationship between Africa and Cuba? And as an African in the West, why should we come aid and support Cuba at this point in time? That's a dual question. The historical relationship between Africa and Cuba, the role it has played, and can you talk to this question of what is our connection and why we should see Cuba as our brothers and sisters, or our allies, and not our enemy, according to the West? Nefa, can you just give us a little backdrop on those struggles and phenomena?
Yeah, that's a big, both huge questions. The historical relationship of Africa and Cuba goes all the way back to when colonialists were bringing us here to the Western Hemisphere in chains. Our sister so eloquently laid out a lot of specifics of the history that as relates to Haiti and other places. And so we have that historical relationship, and so our populations were kind of bound, inextricably bound with our people here in the Western Hemisphere, and Cuba's one of those places. And so the updated in terms of why now, especially when we look at, you know, the struggles of independence, sorry for the background.
Yeah, no problem.
And then also, you know, the current revolutionary government, the current revolution that's taking place in Cuba, we need to support that, because and the relationship of that to Africa is very unique. It's almost like it's not almost. It's like no other in the world when it comes to the Western Hemisphere cross transcontinental cooperation. There is the saying that a lot of us, the Pan-Africanist Revolutionary Community, has when we say, "When Africa called, Cuba answered," and so that's expressing and acknowledging the fact that Cuba, as a revolutionary nation, did a lot of things for Africa, even to the extent of putting bodies in the independence movement, the armed struggle of the independence movement, you know, and that transpired, and people, it's a very detailed history that we couldn't go in here, but people need to look that up. And so there's the Cuba Revolutionary Cuba sent troops to Africa and independence movements to fight and gain the independence. They were recognizing that level of struggle for the continent. And then even subsequent to that, even to this day, that Cuba lends technicians, like, you know, people, literacy technicians who can provide technical assistance like literacy and health care, you know, to our people in Africa. And so this goes all the way back, you know, to the dawn of the revolution, you know, in Cuba. And so that's that connection. And we need to honor that, and it's why we need to actually look at and pay attention to Cuba as a special place within the African, the Pan-African struggle in this hemisphere. And so as Cuba, and as Kwame Ture used to say, you know, revolutionaries, we have to be grateful. One of the principles of a revolutionary is to be grateful. And so Cuba has given a lot to Africa and the African world. They have had they've given a lot to Africans in the diaspora in terms of asylum to people here who sought asylum, political asylum, when they, you know, during the height of different struggles. Assad Shakur is there in Africa and has asylum, you know. And this is a little country, you know, 90 miles off the coast of the United States, that is doing the best it can to try to not only hold its own, but be true to the world with it, you know. And that's not to over-glorify any nation. You know, every nation has, you know, the politics become complicated, but the essence is what it is, you know. And we just have to honor that, and we have to be respectful. So when it comes to struggles that Cuba has, we have to, you know, step up just like they've always stepped up. The original, if you can reach down, I don't know if I answered your question. I might have got off the original question.
No, it was fine. But I was trying to explain the historic relationship between Cuba and Africa, and then the relationship of why Africans in the U.S., particularly in the West, should support Cuba. It's a dual thing, because everywhere we go
right.
in the African community, people see Cuba as being our enemy. It's like a bad word. It's scared to
even
say the word Cuba.
But that's a result of a neo-colonial. Like this, I mean, there's complexities to neo-colonialism. Every stage, like, you know, colonialism, all these things are the enemy's response to our people's struggle. So neo-colonialism is a very sophisticated thing. Along with it comes propaganda. So wherever we are in the world, especially not just with, you know, so we will accept the dominant. Interest or the propagated interest and the propagated interest and allegiances and identification that they put out. And so in here in the United States and any place else, you know, they're bombarding us with ideas and information and narratives that make us say, okay, well, Cuba's an enemy, so we're going to embrace them as an enemy. And that all is all devoid of the history and the connection that we actually have for Cuba. So if you're a person of African descent or anything, if you just any person, period, then you're going to neglect what any narrative that's outside of this dominant discourse that belongs to the imperialists and the capitalists who only want to exploit people. So as African people, we got to know Cuba is predominantly of African descent. Cuba has historically stood against the oppression of people in the world in terms of as a nation, and not a nation whose government just does it, but who the people who are much more involved with the government than we have ever seen in any other place in the world. You know, now Latin America's coming up with it. And so we can see, like, to make it plain, people in the United States are struggling against basic fundamental human needs. And it's more intensified when it comes to the African community, healthcare, education, you know, all those kind of things. In Cuba, that's free. It's not. It's a public, you know, it's just public access to these things. And we struggle against it, but yet the dominant narrative has to tell us that Cuba's wrong because of those things, because they can't provide them. It's incapable of doing it, and so we have to. It has to propagate us away from that example, and so that's why it's doing. So we have to open our eyes and look and seek out information that is that gives us the full story of things.
Excellent. To our Sister Izeli, I would like for you to speak to. There seems to be a a strong attachment between the Africans in the United States and the Democratic Party when it comes to putting our trust and loyalty to this party. Historically, in terms of when you look at the various movements that have taken place throughout the world, in this case, I would like to talk about your particular situation in Haiti. What has been the relationship or the role of the Republican and Democratic Party? And how do you see African people, if any, benefit by continuing to stay under this particular party platform?
Well, it's you know, it goes back to this whole issue of how we need to marginalize the black collaborators. But the idea of this two-party system in the United States is sort of theater, because whether, in terms of Haiti, whether it was Bush or whether it was Clinton or whether it's Obama, you know, we're under occupation that started under Bush and that is continuing under Obama, even worse. At least under Bush, there was a stop at some point to the deportations of Haitians. As you know, black men in general are herded into these warehoused prison-for-profit complex. But there's another sort of sideline complex, and it's called the detention centers for immigrants. And Haitians just populate that. And it's for profit. Like, they're making, you know, $200 a head per night for a bed. And so folks are put in those prisons.
Can you repeat that again? Repeat that point again, sister? They're making how much a night
per
bed?
About $200 per night ahead at these detention centers. And so it's prison for profit. It's black pain getting gain for the imperialists. The new way, it's not actually a new way, because obviously our pain in slavery was about making them profit. But now it's just so covert. The Democrats, and I'm going to speak out names, in Haiti, for instance, during the second U.S. occupation of Haiti, which started in 2004 with the unseating of President Aristide, you have the Democratic Party not saying a word about what was going on. You have they both come together as capitalists across the world. So to give you a historical background with regards to that, back in the day, Haiti was put under U.S. tutelage in 1914 to 1934. It was a 19-year occupation. And at that time, they brought in not the Langley farm boys, but they brought in the Southerners who were, you know, white boys who could not you know, rise up in the ranks in the South were part of the various brigades that went in to find, you know, runaway enslaved Africans. And these are the people that actually made up the U.S. armies. So they brought in 1914 those type of men, and they literally, in Haiti, put us back into slavery. But what's important about Democrats is that Franklin D. Roosevelt, who is credited with the New Deal and with all of these social welfare things that the Democrats are so well known for as opposed to the Republicans, was known in Haiti as the Butcher of Haiti. So here's the Butcher of Haiti, who basically helped put Haitians back into slavery, re-elected in America 4 times, the most re-elected president in American history. So that's just to give you an example of what the Democrats are about, especially overseas. There's no difference. In Haiti, in the United States, they run. See, racism and imperialism is structural at the bottom of the day. So USAID, which to Haitians is a death squad-making agency, but to the left, it's a space where they all can go and find jobs and work in the Peace Corps and work in all of these organizations that the USAID or the NED actually takes and funds. You know, whether it's the Red Cross or whether it's UNICEF in Haiti, they're all about masturbating on black pain, calling, taking orphanages. I mean, this is, you know, we have a saying at the Haitian leadership that, you know, pedophiles hide in orphanages in Haiti. And you have these so-called progressives who bring their lifestyle to Haiti that is repugnant to African culture, who are primarily have no compunction about destroying the innocence of a young boy. You have these Republicans, these Democrats, who say nothing about the fact, for instance, Clinton, when he was, we all know Clinton as a Democrat, we all know how Clinton destroyed whatever safety net was put together during that New Deal. We all know how Clinton got the NAFTA, which pretty much destroyed agricultural sovereignty and other sovereignties of these nations so that they can be dependent on the Europeans. Well, in Haiti, Clinton policy, for instance, of dumping Arkansas rice. Clinton is, you know, probably his wife will be the next president of the United States. But let's just stick with him, you know, not having to go back way back. But so Clinton is you know, to some Lafayette's black collaborators, the first black president because, you know, he played whatever, the saxophone. But this guy has done so much more worse, in my opinion, than any other president with regards to the destruction of the civil rights movement by his various incursions, both in the United States and in the United States, we know with regards to the prison industrial complex, his hand there with regards to the various trades we know. And in Haiti, I can speak specifically to what happened to Haiti with regards to, let's say, we have 70 to 80% pretty much women, farmers and peasants in Haiti outside of, you know, Port-au-Prince, where they all congregate, where the white groups congregate. In the rural Haiti, most people, you know, live off the land. And they would, you know, they would go to harvest and sell their stuff to the major cities and to the major metropolitans and so on. Well, neoliberalism, which most Democrats do not, denounce, is about really privatizing state assets. And so neoliberalism, which is another tool of imperialism and capitalism, what they did in Haiti, for instance, is that 30 years ago we had food sovereignty, which means that we did not import our food. Haitians were able to feed themselves, and probably why I exist today. 200 years of isolation, basically we were able to feed ourselves because, you know, we grew our own. But when in the 70s and 80s and 90s the United States dumped subsidized big agribusiness food into Haiti. There was no Democrats yelling and screaming over it, okay? And Clinton was part of that policy started by Reagan. He gave his Arkansas cronies these huge, huge corporate welfare subsidies. And then what they would do is they would dump their food, American rice, American products, into Haiti so that it totally destroyed the informal economy of Haiti and made people so poor, specifically the women, because they would go to market and they could not compete with their goods and sell their goods at a price when the Americans were undercutting them and practically giving them money either for free or for something that was less. So that's what the Democrats do, not only in Haiti, but all over the world. You have another thing called the Buffett Amendment, where USAID so-called aid, which is really about, you know, it's another form, another tool of financing black collaborators. That's the thing. I think that when we talk about the black collaborators through imperialism, we don't quite really know the specific, you know. So in Haiti, for instance, the way they're 1% of the population owns, and most of that 1% are Syrian and Lebanese folks that Haiti gave asylum to something like 80 years ago when they were. So these light-skinned Haitians are the subcontractors for American companies. And whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, they use them in the same way that they equally the same way. So, for instance, you know, according to like something called the Buffett Amendment, you know, there's all these laws in America that prohibit tariffs and other things against American companies. So, one of the first things that the Bretton Woods organizations do, Bretton Woods organizations like the World Bank, the IMF, the European Union, all of these ways of controlling your borders as a sovereign state, those ways of controlling your borders as a sovereign state, there's no Democrats or Republicans that's like saying this is not equality. They participate in it. They get rich on it. Haiti is a fiscal paradise as well as Africa for Europeans, especially those that say that I rather the KKK than a Democrat, and I said that because they will come in your face and they will tell you all this sentimentality about how they understand your pain. I'd rather the straight up, you know, I don't think you should exist, and then the ones that come in and tell you that, you know, right now, for instance, my voice and the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network's voice is being drowned out by what we call the white saviors of Haiti. The white saviors of Haiti, you know, people like Sean Penn and the people like Paul Farmer over at Harvard, right, and all these NGOs, they're the ones that you will see in Congress. You know, they get to Haiti with, like, you know, X amount of experience being there, and all of a sudden they know how to advocate for the black woman's child. And so the white savior complex is very entrenched in the so-called leftist progressive. And I don't know who told him he could speak for me, but somebody did.
I wanted to ask a question.
Yes. Sister, go ask your question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm switching from, I don't know, the interviewer in me wants to ask you. Because it was great what you said was great. The last thing you talked about is the white savior complex, and also that you were very specific about how things manifest. What would you have to say in terms of how the manifestation and its relevance to things like sexism? You know, because, you know, there's also the white male, older people complex that also has impact and bearing on how things manifest for everyone in the world. Does that make sense?
No. Tell me what you're trying to ask, please. So that I can actually.
Okay. No. This is good. I'm sorry. So how, like, for instance. Oh no. To be more specifically. How do you see, because what you're describing seems to be talking about if we were to talk about the isms, the different manifestations, racism is very obvious in what you're saying. But in terms of sexism, because of when there are other people, but on the ground, there are people like you mentioned, all these white men, they're white men. But also on the ground, there are things that are happening to our women and our girls that are a result of the fact that the dominant forces are all not just class forces, but they're race and gender, you know, whatever forces.
Okay.
So how
I'm going to try to answer it, and please help me if I don't actually answer what you want me to answer.
It's okay. I'm being very vague, and okay, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I will try to at least answer how I feel about that question.
And once she answers the question, let me stop you for a second. Once she answers the question, we'll let that caller know. Caller 4381, we'll be coming to you after the response. So be patient. Caller 4381. All right, go ahead, my sister.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that happened when black folks in America integrated with the larger society, or at least the top layer, folks who were able to get into schoolings and so forth, they used the word minority. And you know, I came to America very young in my life. You know, I was 5 years old. And I remember going to school, and all of a sudden, you know, I was no longer in Haiti. You know, I was referred to as so and so's daughter, but all of a sudden, you know, I was a minority, and I was sort of confused because I came from a majority black country, and I couldn't understand how that affected you know my personality. I think that what happened is that a lot of the gains that our civil rights leaders and heroes and sheroes worked for was somehow given to, in my opinion, using the word minority to mostly, you know, to benefit mostly the white woman. And in Haiti, in my personal experience, I find sexism obviously runs rampant, both in Haitian males and in white males. But with regards to the invasion of Haiti by white folks during this occupation, it reflected in just different ways with regards to the power struggle. You know, when a woman is poor and a tourist comes along, so the sexual tourism is there. But for me, as I look at gender problems in Haiti, and because I work at a different sort of level, I remember. When I was representing President Aristide, I remember sitting across from USAID representatives, and both those representatives were white women. And both those white women were carrying on the racist, exploitative policies of the good old boys would have been doing in Haiti. I remember actually asking, sitting down one day and asking one of these women, I said, you know, don't you feel... There's a conflict here. The blacks died for you to have some position in America. And you are all over, and I can say they are. White women are all over in the various USAID, NGOs, UNICEF, Red Cross, making tons and tons of money. And this white woman said to me that it's just a job. And so that goes back to this idea of what American values are about and how we as a people, black people, have to define ourselves, not allow others to define us. So in terms of sexism, I think I said this yesterday, gender, lifestyle, and race. America likes to try to put all those things in one pot, but they are different. The Holocaust, the African Holocaust, the Masa, was about destroying the black woman's child. And that Holocaust is across in the world, whether you're talking about in Indonesia with the West Papuan, we have that, or whether we're talking about in India, or whether we're talking about China, we who are aboriginal to the world have always, for some reason or the other, but specifically in the last 1,000 years, have been discriminated against because of our skin color, and that to me is that the most important thing as an activist, I run, of course, you know, I run an organization that is mostly males. I am a warrior that leads, and I don't really, you know, deal with the you know, the sexism is always there. It's always what people are going to do. And I represent and have represented many women, African women, from Africa and from Haiti, who are victims of rape because of imperialism and the various power struggles of imperialism and the collaborators and how they fight. Rape right now is a tool of war. We know it's a tool of war that you use deliberately in the Sudan. We know it's a tool. It was a tool of war that they started using in Haiti in 1991 with FROP. So for me, I see sexism as another way of exploitation. And I go in the historical basis, which is why, you know, I my name is Esli Danton, you know, inspired by that irreducible essence of the black mother. So for me, I see it, I know what it's about. I don't actually concentrate on that sexism because I've been lucky enough not to have to in any significant way. My job has always been about the freedom of Haitians and the freedom and providing some sort of intellectual basis for the freedom, for instance, of the entire universe of people, universal freedom. And this is what we talk about at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership. We say that right now there's bourgeois democracy, and bourgeois democracy was Jean-Jacques Dessalines, the founding father of Haiti, did not stand for. Bourgeois democracy is where unlimited freedom, and this is what white supremacy is about. It's where unlimited freedom and unlimited beauty stands and is practically exactly the same space as tyranny, exploitation, and slavery. And Jean-Jacques Dessalines said he did not want to preside over a colony like that. He wanted universal independence. And that's what I stand for. That's what the Haitian Lawyers Leadership stands for. You know, we know, for instance, that you know, there's still pockets in North Africa where there is slavery, there is this, there is that. We know all of those things. And we say that we go back to Jean-Jacques Dessalines, the founding father of Haiti, and his philosophy. So racism is the destruction of the black woman's child across the globe, and imperialism and capitalism is used to have the few at the top with their black collaborators or their mixed collaborators or whatever it is that they want to call them, these mulattoes. You know, that's what the pattern is, and that's what the pattern that was identified after 300 years at Bois Caïman. As I said, you know, we have to stop the imperialists, we have to stop their black collaborators and their evil forces. But then, you know, there is this effort right now, and they try to do it in Haiti, where the lifestyle of the pedophile, because they're all over our orphanages, this use and desire of the white man for the black male sex, to effeminize black children, or to mix our race in some ways. In Haiti, it's done. The colonial army in Haiti right now is doing it on purpose. They bring in very uneducated, illiterate, poor, poverty-stricken Pakistanians, Nepalese soldiers who come from a space where the women are not treated very well. They bring them into Haiti. And poor, you know, Haitian women are subject to all sorts of indignities, and I represent that voice. So I know what that's about. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that's good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take this caller right now. Caller 4381, 4381. You're on Africa on the Moon. Your question or comment?
Oh, thank you, Brother Lee. I am learning so much, and I just feel very honored and blessed to be in on these discussions, to learn more and more. I can just remember as a small child, and I am a retired public school administrator, but just remembering reading about Haiti and how vibrant it was, say, in the 50s or 60s. And somehow something happened when it became such a tourist trap. And I guess many individuals from males, men from New York, began to visit there a lot. And it's interesting that you should bring up that factor around the pedophiles embedding themselves across the world in these communities where the children are to do their dirt. And that is across the world. Africa, Haiti, all over the world. Rio de Janeiro is one of the most famous ones. And so we have so many concerns as a people that it seems almost insurmountable sometimes of how are we ever going to deal with these issues. And so in that respect, I think we still have to, as we've talked earlier and other people have said earlier on some of the conversations, is that we must organize ourselves in a way that we do have to step back somewhat from the systems. And maybe that organization of ourselves as a people at a level of just being those who are genuinely authentically wanting to help and to save the African people from all of these atrocities, and maybe we have to do some sacrificing, the people that are organized to do this work. As an activist, you have to sacrifice something, and I'm just learning more and more and more. And so I think the critical piece is that we organize and communicate with one another and really and truly understand what's going on all over the world, not just in our little spot, because it is all connected. It's just like this huge web of atrocities and of decisions being made. Right now, even that trade agreement that's in the hopper that people are talking about and nobody's really paying attention to, that's going to be devastating. It's going to be exactly what Mitt Romney said in his little, when someone secretly taped his conversation. They actually believe that it is okay to exploit people in other countries, developing countries, who will work for 25 cents an hour. America can't compete with that. Not American people. 25 cents per hour, 25 cents per hour in one of the countries that are really struggling, the people will love that. And then no environmental regulations. The people will be dying from God only knows what with all of the chemicals around in these countries now, and it can be a catastrophe very easily. And I don't understand why Democrats and Republicans are willing to allow that to happen to any people. And so I just say there, those of us who do care, we have to organize and figure out some great ways to communicate with each other, alternative ways of communication, because they can pull this plug on your blog talks, on our emails, on our anything, anytime, to stop anything. On your phones, anything. And so that's what we're up against, and we've got to figure out how to help the people other than prayers. Our prayers are great. We got to pray. But we also have to we're organized.
That point is well taken in terms of you can't expect to use the enemy technology and to make it a major factor of your organizing tools, because at any time they can take it away from you. And this is why I'm more critical. At least once a year,
we have brothers and sisters from all over the world come together at African Liberation Day, where we can have contact face-to-face, primary sources of dialogue to get an accurate reflection of the realities of our people and their conditions globally and how we can work together. So this is why it's critical we are appealing to the masses. There's no more day more important in your life than to come to African Liberation Day on May the 17th in Washington, D.C. at the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest. This is where we can have this serious dialogue, and we need it. We need to know each other. We need to meet each other. When we talk about unity, there are different forms of unity, but right now we more critically need this unity of thought, and that only can come through your two organizations. Carl, we'd like to thank you for your comments and continue to listen. We'll go back to our panel, and we'd like to raise this question with Brother Haki. Brother Haki, in terms of looking at the events that have taken place in Africa, around Africa, what things do we need to be aware of and take from this invasion and this craziness in terms of what recently took place in Libya? This issue that's going on there in Nigeria, Boko Haram, this whole question of even inside the United States, you can see where there's an issue even dealing with folks who are so-called educated. In terms of in the academic arena, they are fearful of speaking about and talking about legitimate realities. What lessons can we learn from Libya? What lessons can we learn from the Iraq War? What lessons and what issues are we looking at to allow something to take place recently in Nigeria as disappearance for over 20-some kids? What is your assessment on that?
Brother Lee, I got bits and pieces of what you're saying. You're breaking up. My phone's about to go out. But let me just try to deal with the pieces I actually heard you articulate. One of the things that when we talk about this kind of African existence among African people, in relationship to the problems that persist, I think the issue of class is one thing, and also the issue in terms of miseducation. When we talk about class, it's very, very clear that people's perception is they have a great deal to lose by even entertaining the idea that the system is fundamentally unfair, unjust, or corrupt. They're not likely to deal with that. So anything that doesn't tend to prop up America, they tend to dismiss it. I think when you look at the situation around the world, and particularly related to Africa, and you look at the kind of situation in Nigeria, one thing is clear, or at least should be clear, is that we're all expandable. And I think what the middle class, what middle class have to understand, is that just like they would use those people in Nigeria to actually carry out, you know, a brutal agenda, they would use them as well. Be it, although they're unconscious in fact that they're doing it, but they will use them nonetheless in terms of carrying out the same kind of policy. So whether you're talking about Democrats who are talking about 100 Democrats talking about $80 billion of reductions in terms of expenditure for the social safety net, or versus Republicans talking about $150 billion, the impact is the same. You hurt a lot of people. And so, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm about to die out. Oh, this phone about to go. Anyway, so the bottom line is that I think that for our people, we have to concretely understand, you know, the nature of the beast, and also I think we have to begin to critically analyze a lot of these values that we hold. So this question in terms of American is very prominent in terms of what it means to be American, and one of the things is just due to the socialization piece. One of the things is that we internalize a lot of values on necessarily understanding we internalize these kind of values. But values like individualism, values like me before anyone else, values like, that material things define who we are as a human being. I mean, once you internalize those kind of values, then it's very clear in terms of, you know, what type of behaviors may manifest themselves. And so I think we'd be very conscious in terms of those kind of behaviors. And I think they're particularly pertinent when you talk about, you know, people in the movement in terms of, you know, which way forward. Because they're all kind of political lines in terms of which way forward. And if we don't have a fundamental understanding of humanity, then we're going to be divided, in which unity may not be possible. But to the extent that unity may exist, it may on a very superficial level. So I think a lot of these values we have to critically analyze And when we see them in ourselves, we have to engage some kind of self-critique in terms of why we think the way we think. But we have to be honest with ourselves in terms of that. Otherwise, any kind of movement is not possible because we're too fragmented and too oppositional in terms of, you know, our stand. I think in North Africa, I think, you know, the human spirit in terms of just the willingness to stand up against oppression, I think it's a lesson that we can learn from, for instance, brothers in North Africa in terms of the Tuaregs, in terms of standing up. And we understand that when the sister talk about this color thing in Haiti, that we understand it exists all over the world, and it's exemplified in Libya, where the light-skinned ones have a real problem in terms of with the more authentic-looking, no, I shouldn't say that, but for those Africans who are dark and who darker features are more symbolic of African, or being African. So we understand that despite the enormous opposition in terms of the Tuareg face, who are very dark people, they persist. And there's a willingness and understanding that that humanity supersedes, you know, any foreign power, supersedes any bureaucracy, supersedes any military, you know, that denies this is humanity. And so I think it's a lesson that particular African middle class have to learn, that at some point we have to stand up, because it comes down to a question of one's humanity. At the moment that you allow people to take your humanity away from them, what do you really have? And that is, I think that is a fundamental problem. But in American context, you know, we tend not to think in terms of one's humanity. We tend to think in terms of things. So clearly a lot of middle-class folks are conflicted. But nonetheless, as the system continues to deteriorate, one thing is clear. A lot of those things that you value, a lot of material possessions that you value, may not be possible, you know, in a very short period of time. And so, therefore, the only thing you really have to stand on is your integrity, your humanity, and that's the only thing you really have. And so I think it's coming upon us, you know, to just articulate just how important it is in terms of, you know, one's humanity. I mean, it's a starting point. So even after all this stuff dissolves, then the question in terms of when you're building a society, what kind of society are you going to build? So we want to build one which is cognizant or conscious of the importance of respect, the one is cognizant and responsible for understanding the importance of humanity. So I think that's your question, Brother Lee. That's all I heard. I couldn't hear make out the rest you were saying.
Yeah, I was asking you also, what's your analysis of what took place in Libya and in Iraq? What kind of impact have those events have had on African people in general, and Africa in particular? What would be your analysis of that?
In Iraq?
In Iraq and Libya. In Libya.
Yes. The impact in terms of on Americans?
No, I
don't think. Go ahead.
Go ahead, brother. No, go ahead. Just give me your analysis.
Impact on Americans, specifically.
The impact that it has had on Africa, in particular, and on the Africans in America in general. What kind of impact do you think these wars have had in those two areas?
Well, I think the impact as it relates to Africa, when you specifically talk about Libya, I think clearly to a large extent it has destabilized the northern region of that continent in terms of, you know, all the fighting that's going on, and so as a consequence you got lots and lots of people you know fleeing their homeland in order to be safe, and so that's precisely what the government wants. My biggest concern is that with the destabilization comes the arrival of U.S. troops in terms of, you know, setting up, you know, their bases and setting up their embassies or bigger embassies for the sole purpose in terms of making sure that they can consolidate a hold on that part of the world. So I think that it has, like any part of Africa, I mean, whenever they do that, it has a destabilizing impact. So now in terms of Iraq. Iraq in terms of the impact on Americans. We got to be cognizant of the fact the power that the media well. I mean, the way that they essentially lied in terms of creating a reason to intervene, you know, in Iraq, knowing full well that was a lie, but being able to sway people to actually believe that in fact that somehow Iraq was somehow constitute a threat to them. I remember Condoleezza Rice in her statement in terms of mushroom cloud, and knowing that's not quite true at all, were able to you know, to sell that, because so many American people are so oblivious when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, not ever understanding that foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy has nothing to do in terms of bettering their lives, even though they believe that foreign policy is going to have some kind of beneficial aspect to their life. Hey, Brother Lee, I'm about to go out. I'm about to cut out.
Okay. All right, we'll move on. As Brother Aki giving his analysis on Iraq and Libya, and Brother Neffa. Well, before we go to Brother Neffa, we still have a call online. We'd like to go back to our young brother, Brother Jabari. He has an additional comment he'd like to make. Brother Jabari, any statement you'd like to make at this time?
Well, I would like to say that I reworked the statements issued by Brother Haki, and he asked a question about the relationship that these conflicts have on black people. I know for one thing it definitely impacts the family, because you're talking about especially those that are young adults that are involved in these conflicts. You're talking about them having to constantly leave children behind at home, and we know that's key for their social development. That time, especially when they're younger, between parent and child, you know, last lifetime and creates all kinds of memories. And if something happened, like you look at post-traumatic stress disorder or a number of other conditions, and that parent's not able to function, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times those kind of things are taken out on the family members that had nothing to do with what they experienced while in conflict.
Okay. Thank you, brother. Brother Nathalie, you know, when we look at this whole institution, we're talking about African Liberation Day, and one of the major features, or two of the major features of African Liberation Day as an institution, is part of the Pan-African movement, or this quest for Pan-Africanism, as well as this quest for international socialism, this quest for socialism. How does this issue play to the recent phenomena in terms of all of these wars that are taking place in Africa, in terms of the microstates, and the Africans don't see the larger picture in terms of uniting in terms of one particular entity? What was Nkrumah, Ture's position on how can Africa unite? Well, that's one of the central features one must look at for this realization of this unity of Africa. How would you address that?
Brother Lee, I have to say, I can't help but my thinking on your question has to do also with the last caller's comments. I mean, I guess maybe that led me into, you know, that last caller's comment, I think, was pretty profound. I would be remiss not to acknowledge what he was saying in terms of the post-traumatic, I mean, like the psychological attack that is a, you know, is a reflection on our people, all of, you know, this reflected and felt by our people all over the world, that is a result of colonialism. And so, and then that's something, again, that's a broad, it's not just African people, but it's people in general, but particularly Africans feel it in a particular way because of, you know, what it means to be African in the world. But your question, I related to what we need to, one, it would be profound to realize this phenomenon, and the institutions that we create to address it have it at this core of their mission. And so, for example, there are organizations in the United States run by African people who are trying to address the post-traumatic stress issues of our youth, our children, based on what we experience here, you know, the violence from the police, everything else. And the same thing has happened in other places in Africa, in the African world, you know. How profound would it be for these institutions and these organizations that work on this to make connections with each other and actually help each other help in their work politicize our youth and prepare them to be the next generation and to try to, you know, recognize their commonalities with each other based on that. And also for our movement to glean the genius that is a product of that collaboration connect those connections. Does that, am I making sense?
He is consistent. No, it makes sense. You make sense, and we run out of time, and there's a question I'd like to raise with our sister here in terms of one of the biggest problems we face is a propaganda battle, a battle of ideas, a battle of propaganda, a battle with this international mass media. Sister Zelly, how would you, you have an idea in terms of what strategies oppressed people could adopt or develop or create to address this question of mass media, who often shape, distort, and sometimes outrage deliberately tell lies all the time on our people and our history. Can you just speak to the people about addressing this particular phenomenon? How can we combat that?
God bless the child who has her own. And yeah, that's what it is. We have to have our own, which is why, you know, I have the ESLE network. And to tell you specifically, you know, one of the sister there was talking, she talked about, the sister described herself as a teacher, talked about how overwhelming the problem is. I think what we have to understand is that it is because we are so powerful that all these forces, you know, we are powerful as a people. Our very genes will annihilate this minority, and he knows it. So, like I said, you know, before, he always has to constantly reinvent what whiteness means. And the problem is we act like we don't see that it's no longer one drop of blood, that now, you know, Zimmerman can choose to be white and forget his Afro-Peruvian. And we have to understand what popular culture is about when we talk about the youth in America, and which sort of America culture is globalized throughout the world. So you have young Chinese and Japanese children wanting to become Beyonce or Jay-Z or, you know, various icons that are held up by the media. And it's always an icon that actually integrates with injustice. Not to say that there is not something positive about what, you know, these icons do, but in essence, what's negative is about what they suppress. And so it's up to us to lift up the young men and women who are the futures of, you know, what's going to be, so that, you know, you know, the values of community, the values of people, the values of being human is elevated above making a buck, and the idea of a job. I mean, there's so many things we have to really discuss amongst ourselves. You know, do we really want to send our children to a school that's going to destroy their minds and make them half their life try to figure out how to undo these lies? Or are we going to have our own institutions? Are we going to go back to where, you know, in those institutions are not going to be about promulgating the lies of white supremacy, but promulgating a liberation theology for the planet, a liberation culture for the planet, which is to say, I always say to Haitian economists, for instance, look at the Haitian informal economy, look at the Haitian market women and how they live, and encounter the World Bank and the CNN and New York Times idea that we are the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, because, you know, these people live off the grid, which is the greatest threat to capitalism, because everyone has to be on the grid in order for them to have any value. And I think we need an alternative system where we redefine what we are already living and elevate it and take out whatever is bad and put in and magnify the good, because we as Africans organically still, even as abused as it is, we still represent that space and time of the ancestors. We still carry the living libraries within ourselves of what we really are, and our very genes will and does annihilate this whole little minority that, like, takes over the world. Their values, like I say all the time, you know, we have to witness to ourselves as the sun does, because we're not going to be validated by the colonial media. But we also have to build our own. And I don't know too much about this unity that people talk about, because I hear it a lot, but I always hear it from my enemies in Haiti. In Haiti, you know, people talk about, oh, we got to unify. And the minute the status quo, The occupied forces in Haiti. Right now we have this colonial government in Haiti, right? Matéli and Lamotte, right? Their big what do you call it? Their big slogan is we have to unify. And our slogan at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership is liberty or death. So, and that was Jean-Jacques Dessalines' slogan, because whenever the imperialist is losing, he wants to pacify you with this universal idea that somehow you have something in common with him. You don't. You know, in Haiti, you know, I have several pieces out there, and I'm going to try to, because I am a writer and I'm a performance poet, and I haven't spoken about any of that. But I have, I want to say that when you look at who and what we are, and you know what it is in your heart, you will understand that we have nothing in common with a group of people, black or white, with a group of people, mostly out of the European mountains out there, who believe that it is okay to build a society on genocide and to continue to maintain that society through creating chaos in genocide and leveraging that chaos and in order to continue to live. Right now, for instance, in Haiti, to be more particularly, they are pushing sexism, but they're pushing it through, I mean, not sexism, sexual tourism. They are pushing, what do you call that, a export economy. This is classic colonialism, and this is how it's represented. It is to confuse the children through all sorts of things. It is, and sexual tourism does it. You know, when you're abused as a child and sodomized as a child, or you're a girl and you objectify as a sexual object, you know, you never really gain your own self in a lot of ways, because you lose that innocence and that desire to believe in faith. You know, you become more cynical, and it's all about getting yours. When you are, and that happens in various ways, as you all know. So in Haiti, and across the world, you have that sexual tourism by the wealthy. White women who go to Haiti and get their stuff off with, you know, young Haitian men who don't have any money and who have no jobs. It's everywhere. It's everywhere in the world, and it's not a world that we really want to promote. And then you have this thing they call export economy. That's how they manifest their capitalism in Haiti and really across the world. The export economy means there's nothing local about what you grow, and it happens in the ghettos and in our societies and communities here too. The black community doesn't understand that its sovereignty has to be about local production, local manufacturing, local use of their own entrepreneurship, because otherwise you are dependent. And once you're dependent, you're enslaved. So we have an export economy that they're pushing in Haiti. And at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership, we're always talking about what investment means is that whatever you use from when you get up in the morning to when you sleep, you've got to look at it and say, you know, was this produced in my community? And if it's not, then there's a need for it to be produced in the community. In Haiti, you know, you wake up in the morning, you brush your teeth, and it's Colgate from some American brand. You don't make the toothbrush. You don't make the plate. You don't make the dress. You don't make, you know, those things we used to do. And we have to get back to doing that and to understanding what that means, because globalization is taking away your power and putting you on the grid. So in Haiti, we talk about local agriculture, local food sovereignty, local health care, all of that, which will make us independent. What will make us independent? And then the other thing that they try to bring to us with Clinton, we were talking about the Democrats and the Republicans. Remember that when the earthquake happened in Haiti, Obama, a Democrat, appointed Bush and Clinton as his representative to Haiti. So they're both essentially the same. So it was the Bush and Clinton Fund. So George W. Bush, who actually took out Haiti's democratically elected government, was appointed by Obama to come and rescue us at the earthquake. The same, and then Clinton, of course, who couldn't even rescue, you know, blacks in New Orleans.
Obama didn't do that.
Yes, Obama did.
Obama's black. I'm just kidding.
Okay.
And then just one thing. I just wanted to say one more thing. In terms of, you know, the pattern of sexism,
The white man uses everything as commodity, including his women, and we have to understand that. In the 60s, when they do this right now, they're bringing in Somalians, Ethiopians, they're going to put them in Utah somewhere, and they're going to put, you know, tons of blondes in front of them, and they're going to end up marrying these guys because these are people that they were raised with. That's what he does. When he wants Libya, when he wants Somalia, he will bring in his white women, and they will help consolidate the empire for him, just like in the patterns of old Europe and the British royalty. That's what they do. That's what they did in Haiti, you know, going into the ghettos, bringing in their charity workers to have sex with the young men that were fighting against the stuff. And then, you know, the black woman is put to the side, and these people are elevated. This is something we all have to talk about because it happens across the board. Their conquest is not just with their military. They use their women. They use everything for the conquest, and we have to understand that, because when you look at Ban Ki-moon right now, a black man from Ghana, okay, who's married to a very, very wealthy, I mean, and these people have mining interests all over Africa. That's how they do it, and we can't just keep talking about theories. We have to talk about the specifics and how we're going to counter those specifics, and so... Please, go look at, I've talked about Winnie Mandela, I've talked about, you know, so we have stuff all over out here in our blogs at EsleyDonfell.com or the Open Salon blog, or some of my work as a performance poet. You can go to YouTube. I use every skill that I have to try to do that, which you asked me about, Brother Lee, which is to create a network where it is our own. And to reach people and talk about the specifics, because we're on the ground doing what we're doing.
You know, just Angie's last point, I think that's why this African Liberation Day, I think they hit it on the head. When you talk about being more specific, we need to identify who are our allies and who are not, who are the real enemy and who are the perpetrator of these issues. So this question of identifying the neocolonial intelligentsia and understanding they are the real true face of counter-revolution, I think that's what this speaks to. We need to begin to really look at who are the real concrete people who are playing the role of oppressing our people globally. Let me just make a quick statement to our listening audience that in a few minutes we'll be going offline. If you listen to us online, you may want to call in at 323-679-0841, 232-679-0841. In a few minutes, we'll be going off. And at the same time, we would like to encourage everyone to come on out to Africa Liberation Day. That's this weekend, May the 17th, at the Festival Center, located at 1640 Colonial Road, Northwest Washington, D.C. This event has been held under the All African People Revolutionary Party, GC, and the time of the event is from 2 to 5. And at the same time, to get more information and to even get a better understanding of this movement, we will encourage our brothers and sisters to write down this website and visit. The website is www.aaprp-gc.org. As always, wherever when there's economic dependency, there can't be no freedom. We need to also learn how to fund our movements. Make a contribution this year to African Liberation Day. That's one of the ways you can truly give back to your community. So we continue to move on. We're just going over for a few minutes. What I'd like to do at this point in time, Nefa, it would be remiss of me to have you share just two things about two aspects of our people's struggle that we must know about a little bit. And yes, so just an update on it. Can you just briefly talk a little bit about who is the Cuban Five? And we know they have an event coming up on the 17th, right after African Liberation Day. Can you just talk to our audience, particularly the African community, who is the Cuban Five, and what's the present update on the embargo against Zimbabwe?
And it's embargo against Zimbabwe? The Cuban Five are five brothers from Cuba, revolutionary Cuba, who were sent to the United States to infiltrate the extremist right-wing terrorist groups that operate, you know, mostly outside of Miami, inside of Miami, to and have orchestrated terrorist numerous terrorist acts against Cuba since the 60s, since the Bay of Pigs invasion. And they infiltrated these groups because of these terrorist acts, and as a result, the United States government arrested them, found out who they were, and arrested them. They've been held. This is 1998 that they were arrested, and they've been holding them in prison. Two of them have been released since, but it's because, and they've just released recently. We're talking about 2 years ago, about less than two years ago, Rene Gonzalez, and then also very recently, just last February, Fernando Gonzalez was released, but that's because they served a sentence. The other three have much longer. We're talking about Ramon Lavignino and Antonio Guerrero and Geraldo Hernandez, who have much longer sentences. In fact, Geraldo has two life sentences plus 15 years, so he would never see the light of day if we don't build a movement to free them. And so that's the short story is that they were arrested for trying to fight the terrorism. But you know, there's a long story behind it, and it'd be too long to go into here. But I would urge people to look up the story. There's one book called What Lies Across the Water: The Real Story of the Cuban Five by Stephen Kimber. That's a good book that people could look at and really get a sense of everything, even to the personal, down to the personal about the each men and their families and the whole mission they were involved in. And what's coming up on this coming Saturday, the same day as African Liberation Day in the evening, is an art exhibit by Antonio Guerrero, who's an artist. And he has a lot of watercolors that he produced while in prison during the time that they were in solitary confinement. Pre-trial, they were in solitary confinement for years, at least 2 years, 3 years, and without access. And so he did a lot of watercolors. I mean, he was able to get access to enough to and so a lot of them express the tribulations that they went through, the five in general went through, in terms of being not access to lawyers and all different stuff and the thinking that he was going through with that. And so that's going to be at Westminster Church in Southwest Washington, D.C. I don't have the exact address, but it's near the Waterfront Metro Station on the Green Line. And so that will be what's happening. It's our exhibit of the art, and so it will be opening reception and some speakers who are talking about the upcoming 5 days of the Cuban Five. And then the exhibit will be in the church after that, but, you know, there will be hours of operation for that.
And in Zimbabwe, what's happening over there? Anything
that kills
people?
Yeah, I can't really, you know, I have not kept up a lot with them in Zimbabwe since, you know, in terms of detail. But the people, of course, the country is still under sanctions. I say, of course, like people should know that they're under sanctions, but most likely your listeners will know that the United States is trying to overthrow this government that led by ZANU-PF that is standing up to the United States and trying to implement things that are empowerment for the people, like the land redistribution and the indigenization bills, which are calling for, you know, predominant ownership of businesses by Africans and black Africans. And so they're putting those things forward, they're having elections, or they've been gearing up for elections, so they've been also in a propaganda war that has pitted the ZANU-PF party, the lead party, against a neo-colonialist created, or, you know, an imperialist created party, the MDC, or which is now split into two, has been split into two for a while now. And so the country's still going forward, and the imperialism is still doing what it's doing. Previously, the assault included a very heightened propaganda, propaganda role in the media. So you would hear about Zimbabwe a lot and hear all this demonization of Mugabe and everything. And now you don't hear so much, even though they're still continuing their methods of destabilization. some of the reasons why I guess it becomes sometimes difficult for imperialism to put what it puts out there, because there have been certain revelations and things in the media can't ignore. It's hard for them to ignore them. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that, because they do ignore anything at a will and whim. But things like the a report that's come out that shows that the land redistribution, and this is a few years old now, the report shows that it has been successful and has, you know, provided things. At one point, the propaganda was trying to say, oh, the problems of Zimbabwe because Mugabe took the land and recklessly, you know, used it for his own bidding, you know, cronies and everything. And so now there's been reports showing that it has not been this, and that there has been an orderly empowerment, indigenous empowerment program going on led by the party, ZANU-PF. And so it's becoming harder for them to put out their own, you know, the false propaganda that they put out. And so I suspect that has something to do with why they're not all in the news. They've been trying to destabilize the country for the last 14, you know, 15 years. With all kind of methods, using, like what we've been discussing, organizations that are buttressed by the United States Agency for International Development and National Endowment for Democracy and all those, and it has not worked. So that's where things are with Zimbabwe, as far as I know. And of course, there's probably more. Unfortunately, I haven't been up with the most current events, and so there could be developments that I think that people should look into.
Okay, now we are near the tail end of our program today. We'd like to encourage our audience that to join us tomorrow evening at 2 hours later. We'll be coming on from 6 to 8 p.m. We will continue our series on Africa Liberation Day 2014 at African Unity. You always can call in at 323-679-0841 or go online to blogtalkradio.com. Africa-on-move. Tomorrow we'll be on from 6 to 8. Please share that with your friends and your network. Tell them the best program in town will be on, Speaking Truth to Power, and we're going to fight until our people get their liberation. In closing, I'd like each one of y'all make a closing remark and statement and respond to how you think they could best serve and help African Liberation Day this year. We start with our sister Hattie. I believe she's still online. Sister Hattie, any closing remarks you'd like to make?
Well, I am just thrilled and learning more and more. And I would just say we must find that alternative communication system. That's kind of just what's critical for us, as the young lady said. We must get off the grid to communicate. They have some great minds around. I don't know the answer, but that would be just something that I would just really hope we can do some think tanks around.
Okay, thank you, Sister Haley. Brother Haki for the African New England Association. Your closing remarks, and how could we help build and support African Liberation Day this year?
Yeah, well, it's definitely something that people need to get involved with, and I think the way you spread the message is keep doing what you're doing. You know, people are aware of African Liberation Day, and so the more you continue to do it, the more people would respond, so just keep doing what you're doing. And also, to sister, my Haitian sister, if you know Lionel Baptiste, tell him how he said hi.
Okay. I do.
Okay, to our sister, we really enjoy your presentation, as always. To our people for this particular program, will you give us your closing remarks, and also how could we best help and serve and build African Liberation Day 2014 this year? One of the things we would like to say to our audience, even though this is a series that we are doing, but each night we reach a different set of population, So this is why it's important from time to time for our panelists to share their expertise, share their story, share their history, because we want to make sure we all have the same history and understanding. So now it's all yours, my sister. Final thoughts and remarks.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I think, Brother Lee, that you're, anyways, I'm very honored to be amongst the people that you invited, because I learned a lot from Brother Aki and everyone else you've had in the last couple of days that I've been on the show with you. So, and I think so that makes it valuable, and you know, sharing information, understanding who's out there and what they're doing. In terms of me, you know, please, EsliDantol.com, EZILIDNTO, you will find some of our work. I haven't spoken any about the performances that we do, but for those who don't understand what the earthquake was about, I actually have a piece. It's called Seismic Shift, Freestyling to Murder Tarzan, Jane, and His Uncle Tom's. And I think it falls into your theme here of neocolonialism and the intelligentsia, the collaborators. So Seismic Shift, Haiti Freestyling to Murder Tarzan, Jane, and Their Uncle Tom's. You can find it at my website. You can Google it. It's a 90-minute show that I wrote about the whole piece. And, of course, you can go to YouTube and see any of our performances. And you can go to Facebook to join the Free Haiti movement. Come and join into the discussion. I'm not always there, but I try to be as visible as I can be. We have a clean water project where we're bringing in solar energy power to rural villages in Haiti, and I welcome any help, any volunteers, anyone who wants to go to Haiti. We're always looking for folks to show them what the real Haiti is and who the real people are and some of the work that the Haitian women are doing, so that they're not dependent on the charitable industrial complex and the poverty camps. So with that program going, it's important because, you know, in our own communities right now, if they turned off the lights, we would not have this communication mechanism. We wouldn't have phones. We wouldn't, you know, what would you do? So it's really important even here that we start thinking about solar power and energy and what the sister was talking about, you know, how we have to work off the grid.
Okay. And our Brother Netfa, your final remarks, how can they best help and support African Liberation Day, and how can they also get in contact with your organization and your works?
Well, I think one thing is that I think we've kind of, a lot in terms of the manifestations and celebrations of African Liberation Day, so it's just, I think we need to get back to the essence of it in terms of what was the, I guess, the thinking of the people who, of the first African Liberation Days and the Conference of Independent African States and all that. And we need to go back to that in terms of understanding the exigencies, the urgent needs for us to unify or not unify, organize on a global scale. And so read that history. You know, we don't really, you know, we need to make sure that history is included in every manifestation of African Liberation Day we do here and anywhere. And so International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five is not really directly related to the Pan-African struggle, but it is related to it. And so our website, or in fact, the main thing is the 5 days for the Cuban Five. So 5 days for the Cuban Five.com is a way to connect with us, and actually the action that's going on with the, you know, the International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five.
As always, we'd like to thank all of our panelists, our call-in, our listeners, and all those who have made it possible for Africa on the Move to exist. We have been experimenting with this technology for the past several weeks, just to see how it could be used as a tool tactically to raise the consciousness of our people and to give our people the proper information that they need. Before I close out, I would like to say about Brother Haki's organization, which also I'm a member of, the African Wellness Association. One of the things that it does on a yearly basis is take freedom ride trips to Cuba. We like to reach out to the African community and all just people to come and ride with us to Cuba on our travel challenges every year. And this year coming up, we'll be going in the month of November, December. One of the ways we can show our gratitude to all that the Cuban people have done to us, particularly when we can talk about the five, because when we talk about the five, we say they are our, even our biological and ideological brothers, because three of them fought in the liberation battles in Africa. They made a conscious choice, willing to shed their blood. As Brother,
that's right.
Brother Kwame would say, Kwame Ture would say, you must, the greatest crime a man or a woman can commit is to be ungrateful. So at least at the bare minimum, if you're a just person, you're a conscious African, or you're one who just want to do the right thing, we can go and say hello to the brothers and sisters. Because psychologically, one of the things these blockades do against people and to countries is to make them become what we call, quote-unquote, undeveloped or unhuman. And what I mean by that is that one of the human characteristics of being a human being is we must socialize and interact with each other. The day when human beings stop interacting with each other, that's the day when we begin to lose our human qualities. These are some of the very subtle things that the enemy will do to us that cause us not to be able to reach our full potential. This is one of these things, not only what they want to do to our brothers and sisters in Cuba, but throughout this world when they tell you that you don't have the right to interact with our brothers and sisters. Well, hell, they took us from Africa without our permission. Why should you give in to any laws saying that we can't go and see each other? So on that note, we'd just like to just share that point with you. And in terms of African Liberation Day, a couple of things we'd like our audience and guests to do for us. If you would share the information of the networks that you have about the upcoming event this Saturday on May the 17th, African Liberation Day, at the center, the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road, Washington, D.C., and the time is from 2 to 5. After that, like Brother Neffa said, we'd like to encourage people to go to the Cuba 5 program, which also we have in Washington, D.C. the same day. And to find out more about the information, about these activities, and about the All African People Revolutionary Party, G.C., they have this beautiful web portal, educational portal. We'd like to direct the people to going to at www.aaprp-gc.org. We'd like to thank you again, our panel, for sharing this information.
The two events are not at the same time. They're on the same day, but one is after another, so you can go to both.
Exactly. And so we'd like to thank everyone. Again, we see y'all tomorrow night from 6 to 8. Get the word out. We ask you to mobilize your forces and share this information with the people. Encourage your network, where you may have in this region or in the area, to come out to this institution so we can get to know each other and begin to organize. It is only through organization where we will defeat the enemy. It is organization is the weapon for the oppressed. We must always understand that, internalize that, and make that happen. And yes, we can. We can do it. Until next time, we see y'all tomorrow night, 6:00. Thank you for listening to Brother Africa on the Moon. Let's go forward, ever. Backwards never.